pleasure to welcome you all to this seminar with Professor Fiona Williams on her most recent publication, Social Policy, A Critical and Intersectional Analysis. Before I start, I'd just like to inform the audience who are present that this seminar is also streamed online. So we also have some people who are following us online today. So first today we will have a presentation or a lecture by Fiona Williams, and then we'll have interventions by invited panelists before we open up for Q&A from you who are present here today. So a few words about Fiona Williams first. Fiona Williams is an emeritus professor of social policy at the University of Leeds. She's an elected fellow of the British Academy of Social Sciences and the social science editor for the Journal of the British Academy. She's also an honorary professor at the Social Policy Research Unit at the University of New South Wales in Australia, and a research affiliate at the Centre on Migration Policy and Society at the University of Oxford. And in 2004, she was awarded an OBE for services to social policy. Now, so Fiona Williams' publications have for many years been central to developing critical approaches to social policy. She has written widely on gender, race, and ethnicity in social policy, and her research has included focus on the employment of migrant care workers in Europe and the transnational political economy of care. And a key concern has been the place of care in contemporary society and the possibilities for a political ethics of care. And her work has been formed by an attempt to understand how individuals, groups, and social movements articulate their needs and how policy responds to this. In her latest book, Social Policy, Critical and Intersectional Analysis, published by PolitiPress in 2021, in this book she brings the global crisis of care, climate change, and racialized borders to bear on an understanding of social policy. The book provides a new and critical and analytical and ethical agenda for social policy and social work. And the book is a joint winner of the 2023 Peter Tausend Prize. And in a judging panel, they remarked that, quote, social policy successfully marries critical and intersectional approaches to reveal the multiplicity of socioeconomic inequalities and the way in which they interlock. The book is strongly committed to humanity, social justice and welfare, and is driven by a call for a radical paradigm change in welfare principles, practices and governance, leading to transformational improvements in people's lives, end of quote. So with this, I'd like to invite Fiona Williams to talk about and reflect on her most recent book. And then, as I already mentioned, after the lecture, we will open up for comments from four panelists, as well as a question and comment session with you. So with that, I'll give the floor to Professor Williams. Thank you.
I'd like to start by thanking the Department of Social Work, Child Welfare and Social Policy for inviting me to Oslo and to talk about my recent book. And thank you particularly to Runa and to Marianne for facilitating the different talks that I've given. So my book operates at a number of different levels. At one level, it seeks to provide a sharper analysis of the complexity of growing inequalities and poverty that characterize welfare states, especially austerity welfare states like that in the UK. Now, if the cover of my book looks as though it could be a book of knitting patterns, I think you call knitting stricking patterns, then there's a logic to that, because it's all about making connections over time, connecting past to future, over space, the connections between different scales of governance, the local, national, supranational, transnational, and global, and across different inequalities and struggles for social justice. Around, for example, gender, racism, poverty, disability, sexuality, age, and so on. And it's about how connecting these together might help us to arrive at a better understanding of the principles and practices that are involved in transforming welfare states. Now, one simple answer to growing poverty and inequalities is to say, well, after half a century of neoliberalism and then a global financial crisis, what do you expect? But my argument is that that's only half the story. We need to understand that these, neoliberalism and financialized capitalism, have thrown up three further crises which are central to thinking about welfare state and social justice. And these are, as Runa said, this isn't working. I'll press that one. There. Just have to press a different switch. These are not only the financial crisis since 2008, but the crisis of care and social reproduction, the crisis of the environment and climate change, and the crisis of racial and migrant justice or injustice. And in this lecture, I want to take some of the work that I've done in my book a little bit further in order to highlight where politically, intellectually, and prefiguratively, if you like, imaginatively, there are important overlaps and synergies between these three areas of crisis. So my arguments are to say that these three crises that I'm particularly pointing up of care, climate, and racial justice are global, even though each is experienced in different ways and it's manifest in different ways in different countries and regions. And I shall explain what I mean by each of the crises as I proceed. But also they bear other similarities. Each crisis threatens our sustainability and solidarity. These are two elements that are absolutely crucial for forging progressive transformation. All three crises amplify poverty and inequalities, which contributes to how both singly and together they jeopardise our mutual solidarity. They all share a common ancestry. All are historically embedded in a colonialist, a patriarchal and extractivist capitalism. And in the last four decades, all have been made worse by neoliberal governance and also by this form of financialized capitalism that itself is crisis prone. Nonetheless, at the same time, all of these crises have been and are being contested both through national and transnational and global movements. So think Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion, the global women's strikes, and how they have affected sort of key developments in policy. They have also led to the sort of struggles around these areas have led to what many call prefigurative practices, practicing in the here and now, often in localities and communities, what is hoped for the future. What we see, for example, when cities take on the role of being sanctuary cities. You know, it's a connection across the world, which means that they're often in opposition to their government's policy around migrants and refugees, where they're committed to making myriad forms of caring and generosity to migrants. Think about the pandemic, how that threw up different forms of people working together to help each other. So these developments have also generated and been generated by new thinking, and that's what I'm focusing on today. The main point I want to make is that all these three crises, they are all interconnected. So applying an intersectional method here is more than just a kind of theoretical finesse. It helps reveal what is hidden or marginalised, that which falls between the cracks, you know, that which falls between those places where the light gets in. And in doing this, it reveals new contradictions and new forms of contestation as well. So understanding the way in which the crises intersect provides us not only with analytical but also political purchase. It's a way of seeing the gaps in social policy and, importantly, as I shall argue, what synergies for change exist across these three areas. And this process is important for thinking about the basis for solidarities and alliances between thinkers and activists, a very important thing that needs to happen more, I think. So my argument will conclude with how together these crises give rise to a new set of political ethics which need to underpin future social policy, what I call in my book an eco-social commons, and in which the ethics and politics of care is central, but it interweaves with other important developments from decolonial and ecological thinking, and that I shall explain. So let me start with the global crisis in care and social reproduction. I argue here that there are two dynamics which are interlocked in different ways in different countries. But the first is the devaluation of care. And that's the long-standing invisibility as women's work, either unpaid or low paid, plus its subordination to paid work and to productivism. It's not just about gender, it's bound up with inequalities across class, racism, migration, disability, and so on. The second part of the dynamics is the depletion of care. And that's the failure to provide the resources to give people the capacity to care and to be cared for. So material resources, time, support, space, all of these sorts of things that people need. And this depletion of care is not only caused by changing demographics, as politicians often say, well, it's all about an ageing society, but actually austerity, in particular neoliberal marketisation and privatisation, have intensified both the depletion of care and its devaluation. But the crisis of care is also global. First, in terms of the global south, where these dynamics are sharper, but they're similar, but they're sharper, where there is greater reliance on a female wage. Neither is the aging of societies just a feature of richer countries. According to The Lancet, by 2050, 80% of over 60s will be in the developing world. Depletion there is intensified by unemployment, wars, climate change, and increased chronic illness. And these place enormous responsibilities on women to care without infrastructural support for basic amenities. Secondly, of course, almost half the world's migrant workers are women. many of whom find domestic or care work in households or institutions of higher income countries. And this creates a further set of geopolitical relations of inequality in care resources, whereby the welfare states or households in higher income countries are able to solve their depletion and devaluation of care, their care expenditure costs, by buying in cheaper migrant labour or domestic labour, adding to that depletion in the countries of origin. While this is a relatively new phenomenon, it reproduces an older condition of colonial extraction, which has been part and parcel of many welfare states. For example, in the UK, after the war, the Second World War, the recruitment of health and care female labour from the colonies provided cheap labour for the new institutions of the welfare state. And it also met a labour shortage, which would otherwise have had to be filled by British married women in a period in which women were assumed to have primary responsibilities for their home and children. Both then and today, with migrant care workers, these workers provide cost-effective ways of securing white family norms and care needs at the sacrifice of their own. Indeed, it reiterates an even longer historical trope of the racialization of female domestic servitude. Now, in many ways, the COVID pandemic represents the collision of all three crises that I'm talking about. First, COVID was a new microbiological form of environmental risk to sustainability. Second, those at greatest risk were those in need of care, older people and disabled people. And those providing care, especially to older people and disabled people in care homes, were of greater risk. But also what was startling was the higher mortality rate in the UK and a number of other countries of minority ethnic groups, on average four times higher than their white counterparts. So in 2020, within the National Health Service, 21% of staff were minority ethnic workers, yet they comprised 63% of all COVID deaths. Now, research by Shireen Hussain has shown that minority ethnic and migrant workers in health and social care face institutionalized racism. They have increased workload and adverse working conditions, including harassment and bullying, and all this intensified during the pandemic. Many work with older people and are in the lowest paid areas of care work. And that means that they had lower negotiating power to ask for better protection measures or for time off when they were ill. Amongst the worst affected were migrant care workers, many of whom were not initially even allowed to access free healthcare. Now, what this collision of crises between racial injustice, care injustice, and the environment, what this collision reflects is a deep but fragile contradiction at the heart of racial and patriarchal capitalism, which is between the systematic denial of race and gender justice and acute existential dependence upon women, minority ethnic and migrant workers to sustain and repair the world. These patterns These patterns were mirrored geopolitically. Low-income countries suffered much more, not only because they have less health infrastructure, but because less than 10% of low-income country populations received the vaccine. And this was exacerbated by vaccine nationalism among developed countries and a refusal to confront the corporate interests of vaccine providers. This raises a whole set of issues in relation to human rights in global healthcare. These issues of injustice and inequality raised by the global pandemic felt like a dress rehearsal or a warning for the policy issues facing climate change and environmental degradation. As Mia Mottley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, has pointed out, the prosperity of the rich world has been achieved at the expense of the poor in the past, and now the poor world is having to pay again for the climate crisis that they didn't create. And this collision of crises was well expressed in a speech by Antonio Guterres, the United Nations Secretary General, in 2020. He said that COVID exposed the lie that free markets can deliver healthcare for all, the fiction that unpaid care work is not work, the delusion that we live in a post-racist world, and the myth that we are all in the same boat. As I said earlier, many of these issues have not gone uncontested. If you look at social and grassroots movements, there have been some very important developments. Pressure, for example, from transnational networks of domestic workers resulted some years ago in an important ILO convention for the rights of domestic workers. We can learn from feminist movements in Latin America and the Caribbean, who have had some success in framing their claims in terms of the rights to care, to be cared for, and to care for oneself, and also aligning these demands with climate change. There's also been no shortage of new thinking. This is a collection of different books that have come out recently, the Care Collective's Care Manifesto, Hilary Cottam's book called Radical Help, and even Joan Tronto's book, and even a queer approach called Radical Tenderness. And many of them build on the ethics of care, which for me has been and is still a central political tenet. And this is the idea that care is central to human life, that interdependence and human flourishing are the basis of human action. Such ideas challenge Western liberal philosophy, in which rationality, individualism, and autonomy are privileged as central to human action. Care ethics have also been applied to democracy, highlighting the values of communication, trust, plurality, and listening. They've been applied to public space and to architecture, all pointing towards the need for the institutionalization of an ethic of care as central to care justice. But what this would require is a new economic model that challenges the priorities of macroeconomics, of productivism, market competition, and consumerism, and the geopolitical inequalities that ensue from that. So, what I'm saying is first that this crisis threatens sustainability across all regions, and second, that its contestation and new thinking have given rise to important issues for change, and that this also intersects with other crises, the second of which I wanted to now discuss. So, this is the global crisis of racial injustice. I understand this as one that combines the dehumanizing policies and practices that are applied to racialized and migrant groups, that combines this with colonialism's long and entwined history with capitalism and white supremacy. Over this century, the operation of racial injustice in the UK, indeed in many countries of Europe, has been a dramatic dovetailing of racist, restrictive border controls with domestic dehumanising and racialising social policies and controls. This is a global phenomenon in which these practices and controls are carried into national spaces. They are operated at the border, but the ideas and practices associated with are carried inside countries. In the UK, this has been expressed as the hostile environment. And that impacts both on migrants and on domestic minority ethnic groups, resulting in degrading and discriminatory practices in the criminal justice system, health and education systems. And of course, these dynamics have been legitimated by ethno-nationalist and populist policies and assumptions that we live in some sort of post-racial period in which discrimination is just an exceptional thing, a prejudice of the past rather than systemic in the present. Now, Ikili Mbembe uses the term necropolitics to understand such policies where the state carries the power to expropriate a group's humanity and, at its most extreme, life itself. This is about, on the one hand, racist microaggressions and dehumanizing practices in public and private institutions, but it's also about the bigger picture of migration. The crisis of racial justice, then, like that of care, undermines sustainability and human flourishing and jeopardizes social solidarity. And of course, it has led to many forms of contestation. The most notable recently was the Black Lives Matter protests, which went global after the murder of George Floyd. And Black Lives Matter was formed by three black women after the killing, after other police killings of black people in the States in 2013. And this was also to open up a profound critique of the concept and practice of human, which, in spite of many years of struggle, does not universally include racialized peoples who are still considered, as Paul Gilroy terms it, infra-human. And what this has done, I think, is force, it's made a space for a kind of reckoning with history, to look at the historical and the contemporary power and privileges of whiteness. And that's been mirrored in the academy, where there's been a lot of pressure to decolonize the curriculum. So whilst necropolitics describes and refers to the history of environmental degradation, which has been built on genocide, expropriation, and enslavement, it's also reflected in global inequalities that have disproportionately affected people of colour and indigenous groups. And this idea of environmental degradation being also part and parcel of minority groups' experiences begins to show how these two crises around the environment and around racial injustice begin to intersect. In his book, The Earth, the City and the Hidden Narrative of Race, Carl Anthony documents the ways in the United States in which racial and planetary subordination and racial and environmental injustice go hand in hand over time. He says this moves from the colonization of both peoples and the earth to the ways in which gentrification, expulsion, and the deregulation of water and waste have hit minority communities. And that's certainly a pattern that's repeated in my own country. Environmental racism, as he calls it, combines with a global perspective. I've mentioned that climate change disproportionately affects the poorer regions of the world. So, for example, the 1.5% reduction in global warming won't be enough for these regions. But also within these populations, women suffer significantly. They constitute the majority of farmers and carers and are more dependent on land and resources such as water and fuel, which are threatened by climate change. Furthermore, measures to prevent global warming can also cause harm. For example, biofuel production as a replacement for oil has created greater competition for marginal agricultural land and has deprived women, especially indigenous women, of their livelihoods. So climate change is also behind the increases in migration. So of the 59 million people displaced globally in 2021, most were displaced because of climate change. At the same time, there's been a strong history of struggle against environmental degradation and ecological damage by communities of colour. In the US, this started in the late 70s. In his excellent book, David Nguyen Pelo writes his book called Critical Environmental Justice. He writes that this movement from the 70s fused discourses of public health, civil and human rights, anti-racism, social justice, and ecological sustainability. It articulated a transformative vision of what an environmentally and socially just and sustainable future might look like. Then, of course, there's the Buen Vivir decolonization movement, which means living well for the environment, which developed in different ways by indigenous people in Latin America, particularly Ecuador and Bolivia. And thinking here centers on a cosmovision in which people strive to live in harmony with nature. One has a commitment not only to close others, but to nature as well. And in terms of new thinking, it's significant to say that many of those decolonial thinkers who expand new ways of understanding humanity, which, as I mentioned earlier, emphasize that this has to be, as Paul Gilroy says, a new planetary humanism, not just about humans, but about the planet as well. Again, as Sylvia Winter, who is an anti-colonial Caribbean philosopher, argues, the struggle of people of colour is more than being against, more than being allowed into present humanness, but one of consciously and communally creating a new ecumenical notion of what it means to be human. That is a humanism which acknowledges and repairs history and moves towards, as she calls it, peaceful coexistence. And she argues, in the context of the climate crisis, this is a praxis that becomes more urgent. And in looking to democracy or democratic coexistence, in common with the care ethicists, the point made by those influenced by Buen Vivir is an emphasis on pluriversality. This means making the possibility for deep dialogue across existing groups, cultures, and cosmovisions, a form of redistributive justice with a respect for difference and diversity. And the aim here is to foster a solidarity and a commonality based upon respect and understanding the position of others. Pluriversality is not to deny universalism, but it's not to assume it either. It's to develop what Paul Gilroy calls a strategic universalism. Now, like the ethic of care, these are also critiques of Western or mainstream thinking, especially a lot of these writers point to the way in which there has been, even within the ecology movement, a marginalisation of these struggles and knowledge. David Pelo, who I mentioned earlier, calls for a critical approach which is both intersectional and multi-scalar, that focuses on the local, the national and the global, and that learns from local prefigurative innovations and works towards solidarity with other struggles. And I read his book after I'd written my own, was surprised at how similar his conclusions were. Let me move on then to the crisis of climate change and ecology. I have to say that from my researching these issues and the literature in this area, I find the same omission that a lot of these others have said. the omission of, I suppose, the whole history of black struggles around around ecology. And I think that this matters because if, as I think may be the case, that the climate crisis offers us most political traction for transforming the world at the present conjuncture, then it's important that these issues are brought out. And so I want to explore the possibility of synergies across these three crises that could bring them together in both analysis and action. And that's one of the things I look at in my book. The crisis of climate change and ecology, there has been quite a lot of movement around combining these ideas with the ethics and the practice of care. So, for example, the Care Society is a report that came out of the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. And interestingly, with reference to Joan Tronto's work on the ethics of care, they say the care society is based in interdependence and eco-dependence as constituent dimensions of individuals and their networks of social, interpersonal and environmental relations. And they go on to say that these two things, care and the environment, must be considered together. I think it's one of the most progressive sort of reports I've seen developing that. And I'm actually also working with UN Women, who are working on a similar sort of development of ideas around feminist climate justice, bringing these sets of issues and ideas together. So it raises, climate change raises important, of course, important policy questions. How can sustainability, adaptation and mitigation policies be developed and implemented in ways which are socially just and equitable and enhance the capacity to care? And how can the ethics of care be central to a sustainability programme? That's what these ideas are dealing with. But perhaps the biggest sort of alignment between centering care in society and green or eco-politics comes from the challenge to the organisation of the economy, as I mentioned earlier. Because welfare, if we take the welfare state development has been dependent on a growth economy. And most literature on the welfare state says this, right? Most politics say this. But insofar as that growth economy prioritises productivism and a consumption-based society, then it, of course it's inimical to environmental and ecological sustainability, as well as counter to an ethic of care as the basis for societal organisation. So for both, we need a new economic model. Now, one very interesting, I think, set of ideas has come from Kate Raworth in her book Donut Economics. Now, you won't be able to see all of that, but she puts flourishing at the centre of economic organisation in order to arrive at what she calls an ecologically safe and socially just space for all humanity. And I think it's her book is really well worth reading for the way in which she argues in as an economist about how this is quite possible to do. And then there have been other important writers on the environment who touch on this question of flourishing and so on in the same way as the care ethicists. So Tim Jackson, for example, argues that moving away from efficiency and productivity as the objective of paid work can put value on those areas of work such as care and craft work, which are less amenable to increasing productivity. And he also argues about how this creates attention to how this could create more attention to time, developing shorter paid working hours and so on. The sorts of ideas that that have come up from time to time, and then they disappear, and then come up and disappear again. However, as I said, whilst the significance of geopolitical differences in the between the North and South are recognised in many of these writers, there is a marked lack of reference to racial inequalities, to decoloniality, and to environmental racism, or to the intersections between care and racial justice, such as we saw in COVID, or to the more diverse history of struggles around these areas. And this, I always find this surprising, because a lot of ecologists do point to the Buen Vivir movement as being one that inspires them, but then it seems to finish there. So let me suggest some further synergies in the form of concepts which make connections between these three areas of crisis. In earlier work, I've called these conceptual alliances, in other words, concepts which enable an analysis of the intersections between phenomena and also have the potential to serve as a political issue that can align different groups or movements. And the four examples I'm going to give are not surprising in a way. One is migration, which works across all these three areas, right? And it's a much researched issue in care for reasons that I've already mentioned. And it's also important because of the struggles of migrant care workers over citizenship status and their conditions of work. But also, again, as I mentioned, migration and the displacement of people experiencing climate disasters is becoming an urgent issue. And those most affected are those in the least developed countries, as I've said. And with them, it's women, children, indigenous groups, migrants, people with disabilities, and the small islands who are particularly vulnerable. And as we know, increasingly there are barriers being created to both the care of refugees and the legal rights of migrants, a central dynamic to the racial injustice crisis. And interestingly, at the moment, climate migrants can't even claim refugee status. So there are a lot of issues across these areas. So what I'm also saying is, I'm trying to say that the principle of hospitality to the universal stranger, as Derrida put it, needs to be part of the ethics of care. The second area where I think a lot can be worked across these three areas is the concept of extraction. And it's been central to an understanding of the exploitation of the planet's resources. It's a central concept. But Naomi Klein very interestingly writes about its connection to other issues. She talks of extractivism as a feature of capitalist development, which she likens to populations locked into reservations, populations locked out of borders or locked into prisons. And extraction has also become, very recently, an important concept in our thinking about the welfare state, work that's been done on the British welfare state. I mean, earlier I referred to the post-war recruitment of care workers from the colonies after the war. But a new research by Gurminder Bambara has shown how deeply regressive forms of taxation which were inflicted in the 19th and early 20th century upon colonised populations, the British colonies, particularly India, during colonial rule, that taxation was brought back to the British Treasury to fund the development of the welfare state from the late 19th and early 20th century. And she calls this the relations of extraction in the welfare state. And there's much to be developed around applying extraction to questions of social policy. The fourth one is, and I'm almost finished, is the question of reparation. There's been some important recent discussion in the climate change literature for reparative justice for climate refugees. And here again, there are synergies with discussions in health and care circles. Not only is care work itself a form of reparative work, work that repairs, but migrant care work forces us to think about issues of reparation to address the depletion of care in migrants' countries of origin and the need for greater infrastructure there. And there have been, the World Health Organization has introduced some codes of international practice around compensation for recruiting doctors, say, from poorer African countries, offering free training and support for migrant workers when they return home. But I think this has to be much stronger, and it has to be framed in terms of the principle of reparation rather than compensation, because that opens up a much broader historical understanding about the nature of both the movement of migrant workers, but also the historical aspect of climate change. In fact, in recent work, I've argued that an analysis of care, which is often employed Nancy Fraser's ideas of redistribution, I don't know whether you're familiar with this, redistribution, recognition and representation, I've argued that there is a fourth R in that, and that is reparation, right? That needs to be part and parcel of the struggles for social justice. The fourth issue is that of humanism. And this is about what it means to be human. How do we signal both our plurality and our interdependence? And whilst care ethics stresses human interdependence, in much writing on ecological justice, especially feminist ecology and Buen Vivir, this is extended to a view of holistic planetary interdependence. And therefore an obligation to consider non-human beings and living organisms. Climate change at the same time invokes intergenerational interdependence. It behoves us to think about the needs of future generations, right? While decolonial thinking looks to reparation, which is due to the present generation in terms of what past generations have suffered. And this also overlaps with Gilroy's notion of planetary humanism, the future generation. Not a Western humanism, but one that stretches both globally and planetarily. And linked to this, of course, is the question of solidarity across difference. One of the key arguments by environmentalists is the need to develop policies which encourage social solidarity and participatory democracy. But as the perspectives I've outlined on care and racial justice make clear, this has also got to recognise and respect difference. Intersectionality, therefore, is not only a theory, it's a caring democratic practice in which marginalised voices are to be heard. Now, I can talk about examples of that perhaps in the discussion, but let me bring this to a conclusion. I've proposed that thinking policy and action around transforming care and the environment and racial justice can be strengthened by bringing together transformative thinking and action in all three areas. So to sum up, this would emphasise, and these are the political ethics that I develop in my book, the relationality of our being and our interdependence as its living enactment. It would be underpinned by the principle of human flourishing. And in doing this, it would extend our moral obligations in quite a big way compared with what that has always meant in welfare states, our moral obligations of redistribution, recognition, representation and reparation. So first, which I've put up, relationships are planetary in a geographical sense of there is a global interdependence. Secondly, relationships are planetary in that there is an interdependence between humans and the ecosystem, which it extends to non-human beings and living organisms. Thirdly, these interdependencies summon up intergenerational obligations to future generations who will inherit the planet that we now live in. And fourth, they invoke dehumanized racial and other suffering, disability suffering as well, of past generations, which signify material and moral obligations towards reparation. So all of these, I argue, demand a more radical and critical understanding of humanism, in which cooperation, coexistence, and solidarity are enacted in respectful and caring democratic dialogue that can balance universalism with pluriversality. Thanks very much.
This very intriguing presentation. Now, before we open up for questions and comments, I'd like to invite Håvard Aaslund, Ariana Fernandez, and Cecil Neumann, and Alejandro Nieto to come forward to this, to have your seat here up front. And we have invited these four panelists to prepare some comments based on their research interest and profile. And then, so I thought we could start with Cecil Neumann. And I mean, your research has very much been within critical perspectives on care. And I wonder if you perhaps could comment on how Fiona frames care work as part of a broad analytic framework and what you believe can be gained from it. Just a minute. You're on.
As I said earlier, I find this work really intriguing, challenging, sophisticated, and also quite complicated. And the first thing I was thinking about is how to actually deal with an intersectional analysis and approach, how to sort of handle all the different dimensions and how they intersect in an analysis of the global situation that we're in right now. Fiona Williams, I really appreciate the emphasis you give to care, because as you, I think that there are two main things that we should always be interested in and preoccupied with as human beings. We all need to be cared for, and we need food and shelter and things like that. So basically, I agree with you and with Nancy Fraser that we have to sort of keep those two main issues in mind always. And then my sort of question or comment to you, and obviously when I ask a question you could blame me for not having really read the book, and you have to do all the say the argument again in a way, but I'm thinking about my own research within the child protection services, and their care would be a core value for the work that the social workers will be doing, but still there's so much control, so much power, so much racialized practices so much lack of sensitivity towards gender and class. So what would be your comment to that? And what, I mean, to the actual workings of different parts of the welfare state and its institutions, like the child protection services.
Should we perhaps? Do you want to respond immediately, or do you? Yeah. So we'll then continue with the order you are seated, Håvard. So you, we know you have had an interest in action research and also focused on social movement mobilization, among others, among the homeless in Norway. And so I wonder if you could perhaps comment on the potential on your reading of William's book for examining social movements and the contestation within the Norwegian welfare state context, perhaps.
Yes, thank you. I really enjoyed reading the book, and also I thought about, I like the concept of welfare subjects, as you use it, and where you frame the analysis of especially that chapter around the dimensions between the everyday and the strategic and personal and the political, which is maybe more known. But I think that really in both for social movements, I would say, and other who are working on social problem construction, it's an interesting way of framing analysis, and also for action researchers, that's myself, who are working on everyday problems and making them political. So in a way, it's about this analysis of yours, I think, really grasps all the dimension of what is on the way from becoming private issues to becoming political and public problems, really. And I also really enjoyed how this was taken up in, and I have forgotten the concept, but it's about the structures of feeling. Yeah, how there are some problems, some issues that we don't really have words for yet, or we don't know how to frame them yet, but they are there, and we can collaboratively maybe and democratically work on making language of them. And I think that's a real challenge for social work and social policy.
Thank you. And Ariana, I know in your most recent publication on anti-racist social work, and also in your past, on your dissertation also, you're concerned with the migration policy and activation policies for migrants to Norway. And I wonder if you could share some of your reflections on your reading of the book. Yeah.
Yes, and first of all, I want to say thank you for the opportunity to comment on the book, because it has been really inspirational, I have to say. And I would like to thank you, Rune and Marianne, for inviting Fiona to actually come here and for us to be able to engage in this conversation. I have a very basic observation that has been very useful for me by reading this book, and it's basic because it's grounded from my perspective, and I like the way you combine intersectionality into critical social policy, and you actually create a space for analyzing intersecting social positions. And I think it's really vital for the development of the field, and not only for social policy, but also for society in general. Because you are so clear, you are very blatantly clear that scholars in mainstream social policy doesn't really acknowledge the issues of race and racialization. And that has severe consequences for people who feel the effects of racism in everyday lives. So departing from a Norwegian context, I very much agree with your critique, and I very much appreciate your blatancy about it. Because also here in Norway, I feel that, we can document that it hasn't been acknowledged as much as it should. And while me and my colleague Marianne Rukus wrote the book in anti-racist social work, it became very clear that social policy doesn't have that many studies to show to from a Norwegian context, and also not from a social work context, and which is surprising because as a social work profession, it is a very clear mandate that we should work actively against it. And even though it's so clear, we don't find the literature, the studies that we need to actually expose and show how it takes place. So I think just for you creating that space and making it and challenging the mainstream social policy, that I think it's the biggest lesson for me, because I think other scholars within social policy should pick up on that and try to be part of analyzing that and be part of the solution that you are envisioning. So thank you.
Thank you. And last but not least, Alejandro, you've been concerned with the migrants' sense of home, I know, and also in past also done studies of the sense of home among the homeless, also in Madrid. And I wonder if you perhaps could try to comment on these intersections between migration and nation and construction of family.
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. I like the book very much because it combines intersectionality and critical approach to understand social inequalities and power relations. And to me, intersectionality and critical approaches were quite similar in a way. So the book explains very much their differences. And if you are wondering about these differences, go and buy the book. It's very good for explaining how they are different and how can they be used in this context. Also, the book does a great job at putting social justice at the forefront of this analysis. And it explains very well how social policy can be understood as a practice and as a framework to understand social justice. So that, to me, is very important. Now, going to the family, nation, work, nature framework, which is the framework that I was very interested in, it is used for analyzing a wide range of issues. And it is both sophisticated and also very empirical. So I like that very much. So I'm going to make 2 points. One is about how this resonates with my own research about home and migration. And then I'm going to make a little question. So I've been interested in migration and home for a while, how this connects. One axiomatic thing in my research is that home is at its core an exclusionary dimension. It is to differentiate the inside from the outside. So this is very clear in the domestic space, of course, but we can scale it up to other realms, such as the nation, and that is the homeland. So your book shows in great detail how institutions of welfare use bordering practices to differentiate between insiders and outsiders, and how they create hierarchies of inclusion and exclusion from social rights. This reminds me a bit the term of domopolitics coined by William Walters, who talks about home-related social representations, emotions and moralities to the nation as a homeland. This logic has been largely used to justify the home space as something that needs to be protected from outsiders or outside elements such as immigration. And the metaphorical use of home in the context of the nation in public discourse and policy practice can be a space for production of different positions, agendas, and different social actors use it in multiple ways. But there is a normative subtext about bordering practices. And my argument is that this subtext can be addressed through a home perspective. So the subtext is reflected in immigration policies, also discourses on migrant integration, and also ideals of citizenship. So migrants are expected to feel at home in receiving countries as a precondition for the legitimacy of their presence. The practice of social policy can facilitate, of course, or deter how people make themselves at home as a migrant. And welfare states are interested, of course, in issues of integration or incorporation, whatever they want to call it. But I guess these debates could be framed in ways of how people make themselves at home or not. And these could be useful in a Norwegian context and perhaps in other places as well. So that was the first point. And now the question. I understand that the family, nation, work, nature framework responds to historical processes in Europe and the UK in particular. I understand that this framework can be used in other contexts, for example, in Asia. But I was wondering if this framework can be extrapolated to understand social practices, social policy practices in contexts like Costa Rica, for example, or Korea or Japan. And if you have had an experience or other scholars have done so. And I wanted to ask if you have had an experience in using this framework in analyzing practices, social policy practices, in places where there is no welfare state. And I will leave it there.
Thank you so much, all of you. Fiona, do you want to respond to any of these comments and questions, perhaps?
Oh, well, thank you very much for those comments. Really interesting. To some extent I want to think about them, but I have to reply. I'll go through in the order that you raised them. Cecilia, what you raise is, you know, that I write about this and about all these possibilities. And in fact, you know, when you come down to earth, there is a lot of, as people would call them, the microaggressions of everyday racism and sexism and ageism, you know, operating not only in the social, but through the state as well. And of course, that is the case. And what's interesting is, I've been in this game for a long time, and when I was writing work in the 80s, in the 1980s, it contributed to and was part of a whole recognition of how important these things were and how important they were for those who were employed as teachers or as social workers or, you know, and at that time, in the UK and in other countries as well, there were kind of radical magazines, you know, that were about teaching or about social work, which got people together. And out of those, there was the combination of the sort of academic work that had been documenting the sort of racism and sexism and everything, combination of that with some of the social movements, you know, around women and domestic violence or whatever, with the public sector workers who themselves were organizing themselves. That was such a powerful way in which social workers, since you raised them, social workers began to take up questions of anti-racism. What did anti-racist social work mean? And I suppose one of my concerns, you know, in writing the book, was that disappeared. It became it provided some sort of platform in a lot of areas of public sector services, but it also became subject to a lot of dismissive rhetoric from subsequent governments. And they didn't, not necessarily only right, you know, conservative governments, but also New Labour as well. Oh, we're through all of that. We don't need that. You know, we've arrived at somewhere else now. And that process of kind of saying, oh, we don't need this anymore. We've arrived at that, meant that they disappeared from view. And in a way, this is why I've written this, you know, so that move. And there were mistakes made. There's no question about it. Anti-racist social work in the 80s and 90s made huge mistakes, you know, which now I think a lot of mistakes about lack of recognition of different forms of ethnicity, different forms of culture, and what that might mean, overstressing culture, you know, not stressing enough racism, you know, all of those sorts of things. And a lot was learned, and I feel in a way that that's what I'm trying to do. That's a, I'm saying, what have we learned from that movement and the way it went underground, you know, and is now coming to the surface in different ways. And I have to say that the ways in which it's coming to the surface is more likely to be in the kind of the groups and community organisations that are not organised through local councils or through the state. You know, they're coming up through the local NGOs more. But even so, I think there is quite a good basis for that. It's just that people have felt awkward about raising it. So this is partly about getting people to kind of come back to some of these questions, for people in those areas, teaching those areas, to start teaching them again, start thinking them through, what's it mean for practice. So that, you know, that's my contribution. I mean, at large, of course, it's very easy to get depressed, you know. And so you have to, I mean, you have to form organisations, I think, you know, to deal with these sorts of things. And in a way, I mean, what you raise relates also to what Hova, is that the right? Yes. raised about welfare subjects, because in a way, that question of the everyday struggle and how people resist in the everyday, I think that was one of the things that tended not, well, it was. I mean, the feminist movement was also always about the personal is political, right? But I think that it sort of was a bit too overlaid with, you know, it's the big social movements that change things. And then the big social movements, they kind of disappeared from view, or they went into the big sort of big transnational Beijing, you know, all of those sorts of things. They went into into women's organisations in the EU, for example. That's where a lot of the feminists went from different countries. They went to upper level, and they lost contact with the grassroots, you know. But actually, it's how those everyday experiences get to be articulated. It's why those small groups, I mean, I talk about Sarah Marie Hall's work and Eleanor Jupp's work that looks at these community groups of women organized often around the fact that they're single parents, or they're poor, or they don't have enough facilities in their estate, how those groups can actually begin to make small changes, but they're changes that are nevertheless important, because they eventually can link up with other groups making those changes. Actually, one area that isn't so much around that, but I've been very involved with, is about the way in which the privatised water companies in Britain have been putting sewage into the rivers and into the sea. It's a big issue in Britain at the moment. And, you know, in the place where I lived till recently, we did a lot of work locally. And it was very interesting that it was one of those issues that could get everybody going, you know. And we very quickly moved from just little groups talking about it, you know, little groups of swimmers like me talking about it, talking about the dirty water, to eventually, you know, in the last few weeks, the water companies being held to account. You know, it is amazing if you get some sorts of issues that you can you can move on them. But yes, oops. I also like that Raymond Williams' ideas of structures of feeling. I think it's that, because one can get so depressed and not see where change is happening, you know? And what Raymond Williams talked about was that it's like the accumulation of tiny changes, you know, and you suddenly find, I mean, marketing advertisers are absolutely, they're so perceptive about these things, how little changes you can see accumulate till something is changing in quite a big way. And I mentioned to postgrads yesterday that work I did in the about 20 years ago on changing family forms was exactly about that, how you could see that you know, at that form, at that time, you know, everybody had a cousin who was gay, kind of thing, you know. Even though there was a lot of homophobia going on, people would say, oh, well, we've got a cousin who's gay, and, you know, oh, you know, we like them, and, you know. And there was a kind of shift going on around all sorts of family changes, around what divorce meant and how you coped with divorce and where the children stood in divorce, which were just not recognised by policymakers. So, yes, I'm glad that you like that, because I think that that has a lot to say for people who are working in public sector areas. Arianna, yes. Well, thank you for your comments. I think that yes, if I've created the space, and in a way that's what I've been talking about, if I've created a space for these ideas to be discussed, that's just absolutely great. And you know, and the I'm passing the the responsibility back to you all. You know, that applying, if you can apply some of these ideas, even though. And also make clear what doesn't fit, you know, what you need to think about yourselves that is different about your own. I mean, you know, Norway is a country with indigenous people. You know, there are all those sorts of differences that have to be explored. And what's the relationship? What's the historical relationship between that and the way in which minority ethnic groups are now treated? You know, is there a relationship? What's its nature? And so on. And, you know, in the same way, there's a lot of Australian academics have done. But I'm, you know, I'm humbled by your comments, actually. And then Alejandro, that is so interesting, that idea of home and the relationship between that and those feelings of being at home and the expectations of what it means to be at home and that relationship to nation and family. I haven't heard that before. So that is absolutely inspiring, you know. And if that framework can contribute to any of that, that's really interesting. But yes, I worked with a group of academics who are looking at mainly at migrant care work in the Pacific area, I've forgotten the book now, they wrote a book and I wrote the preface to it, and I was a sort of advisor on the research project. So I got to know quite a bit about South Korea and Japan and the way in which it was possible to apply these sorts of ideas. Japan, very, very interesting, of course, because on the one hand, in terms of family life, experiencing you know, an aging of society and you know, questions of care, just like other countries, but at the same time having a kind of historical distrust of the foreigner, right? And this tussle in Japanese politics between, but we need migrant workers, and the kind of cultural idea that, but you know, we don't live well with people from other countries and other cultures. And finally, giving way to allowing migrant workers, as long as they could prove that they were some sort of ethnic, they had some sort of ethnic relationship to Japan, right? Absolutely reinforcing that idea of you could only relate, and especially in the care relation, which is what they were concerned about, you could only relate to people of your own sort of heritage, you know? And I thought that was a very good example of all of that. But certainly, in terms of issues of countries that have no welfare state, no, I haven't done that, although I've heard other people say that would be possible to apply it to very poor countries. I mean, especially that whole question of ethnic conflict and how that arises and the impact that has on care and families and so on and so forth. So, yes, I mean, it's a challenge that I have kind of partly set myself. So thank you for reinforcing it. So I think that's it. Well, other people might have questions. Yeah.
Exactly. So do you want, any of you want to comment?
Yes. No?
So in that case, I think we can dismiss the panelists, and then we'll...
Thank you very much again.
And then... And then we will open up for questions and comments from you here in the, who are with us here in person. Anyone who would like to start? While people are reflecting on the questions, I could start myself perhaps. I wonder if you could perhaps, now we have outlined a sort of a vision for social policy research, but maybe we could also be a bit more explicit perhaps on your assessment on the current situation in social policy research. Especially towards the end of the book, you talk about also the fragmentation of social policy research, perhaps.
Yes, that's right. Mm. I mean, I think, well, certainly in the UK, these questions are being taken seriously. But I think one of the problems is that social policy research often relies a lot on government funding, and so what becomes difficult is to kind of reinterpret government's agendas. And what I think, I hope I'm not saying anything out of turn, but I think as well in Britain, the ESRC has found itself more subject to government agendas than it has in the past. And therefore, what researchers, if they're going to get money, I think the EU money actually has more room for manoeuvre, I think, than often national national government funds. But you do have to play an act of reinterpretation. You know, you do have to sometimes present your research funding submissions in this language, whereas you're actually going to carry it out in another language, you know. And it's possible to do that. I mean, the big research grant that I got to do Changing Family Life, we did that. You know, we put it in as one thing, but we knew that we wanted to do, we wanted to follow it in a very particular way. That's about just being a bit clever, I suppose, at the moment. I mean, it might be easier in Norway than it is in the UK, but that is one of the problems. I think the other problem that affects academics is, and I, again, I don't know whether this applies, I think it probably does, to Norwegian academia, is that the sorts of hoops that you have to jump through in order to show that your work is, say, socially relevant or something like that. Well, in the UK, we have a system of assessing different universities and how their research is, the research assessment framework. And often that requires people to show that their work has had an impact, has socially had an impact. And there is a hierarchy in what sort of impact that you might have had. So if you've had an impact on, I don't know, the treasury, you know, then that scores high. You know, if you've had an impact on a small estate and the way they're going to reorganize the play areas around their estate, that doesn't score high. And I think that that's one of the problems, that people feel that they have to go for the big impact rather than stick with something that they maybe feel has a much greater long-term value. So that's also one of the problems. I think also with these questions around, with all the sort of areas, feminism, anti-racism and critical race theory, disability and so on, I think that's where I've said I think there's been a lot of fragmentation. In order to make their careers, right, people have to kind of go into one area and develop it. And that it kind of moves against interdisciplinarity. You know, people stay in that area, they become a very well-known feminist in this, right? And that's where they stay. And that process whereby your career depends on you having made a mark in a certain area is also one of the problems. So there are all these problems, but I think at least now we're beginning to talk about them. Not to say all the problems of, you know, which students do you have and who are you appealing to and how do you make courses more appealing to minority groups and so on and so forth. Yeah.
Thank you. Another question that I had myself was also you mentioned or touched on also the literature on new social risks.
Mm-hmm.
And you position also yourself a bit in relationship to that. So I just want to invite you to perhaps elaborate a bit on that.
Yes.
To share that.
Yes. Well, I mean, are you familiar with the literature on new social risks? I mean, yeah. It's come out of a lot of the work on Europe, on poverty and inequality in Europe. And basically, it's pointing to the fact, in a way, not dissimilar from my work, that inequality and poverty are complex now. You know, they involve different groups. It's a sort of thing that it hasn't remained the same. So there are, you know, single parents, disabled people, minority ethnic people. These are people who have been exposed to precarious work, to family policies which has excluded them, to cuts in care services and so on. And therefore, there is a particular way in which some of the processes in society have created new social risks, right, that affect particular group. Now, I don't disagree with that. I just think that it doesn't focus enough on the question of social justice. It focuses on the process. It focuses on social processes, but not enough on social justice. and where we need to see the continuity of marginalization of those groups rather than them being the result of some of the ways in which society so we need a dual approach, I would say. I don't know whether that answer is enough of an answer.
Yeah, thank you so much. Anne-Britt Juve. Yeah, you need a mic. Oh yeah. The GDPR regulation says I have to repeat your question. So yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it made me remember a paper written by two Norwegian economists some years back. And the name of this paper was The Equality Multiplier.
Oh, yeah.
And I think their main argument was something that when the majority in a population, a country, have fairly equal economic situation, then the majority also have an interest in a general welfare state because they all benefit from it.
Yeah.
But when differences are much larger, then only a minority of the population would benefit from that kind of generous welfare state. But now it seems to me that most of Western Europe is not in that kind of situation. Mm.
Yes.
Which is kind of depressing.
Mm-hmm.
So my small question for you is, are you optimistic at all about how to change this? Can we change it?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Just for the record of the online audience, the question is, are there any reason for optimism on the behalf of the welfare state?
Yeah. Yes, I think there is. But I recognise exactly what you're saying. And of course, that whole question of the importance of solidarity to the welfare state has been absolutely central to Nordic welfare state studies. And in a way, you know, that's what I'm critiquing, not the idea that solidarity is important for an acceptance of state protection, but the fact that idea began to be questioned by some in social policy when it became obvious that the Nordic countries were now becoming more differentiated in terms of ethnicity, right? And so, but what shall we do? Because we won't have our universal culture, our universality has depended on us being all, you know, all Swedish. Mm. And so it's had an unfortunate history, that idea, even though I agree that solidarity is at the center of support for a system. But that's precisely why I raise that question over what universalism should mean, right? Mm. Because that idea of solidarity, welfare state, and universalism has been tied together. And I want to say that actually we need to think about solidarity differently, we need to practice it differently, we need to push it differently. And if we think of it, of pluriversality, as a way of accepting difference, right? Not being alarmed by difference, but beginning to accept it. Working out, of course, what are the baseline values that we all go along with, but accepting degrees of difference. Then I think that whole question of solidarity can begin to kind of re-emerge. Well, it is emerging. I mean, Alejandro might know about this, but in Madrid, Barcelona, in Barcelona, there is a movement, and it's been written about in a book called Fearless Cities. It's called Fearless Cities. And although it's becoming a little bit undone at the moment, that's a different issue, the whole development of fearless cities has been based in Barcelona, where it's actually, I mentioned it in relation to sanctuary cities. Sanctuary cities is a very similar sort of movement, where in Barcelona they've worked on developing strategies around homelessness, around aspects of housing, the environment, social services, poverty, and they've done it through alliances across different groups, based particularly around feminist groups, anti-racist groups, pro-migrant groups, disability groups, and they've really worked at putting into action the question of alliances and how those work. And they base, in fact, I've got a quotation, I didn't go into it. It's called the Global Municipalist Movement, yes. They combine feminist, anti-racist and environmentalist policies. And they talk about taking back control of the city, you know, by ordinary people. And they've done quite a lot of work, and they've linked up to other cities where similar groups have been developed. So, you know, just looking at my notes, they address questions of gender and domestic violence, creating sanctuary cities, but putting a lot of pressure on the local council to come up with you know, the right to housing and so on and so forth. And as they say, the first principle is putting care at the centre of both the political agenda and modes of organisation. So they're really putting into practice some of these ideas about how you work across different groups. There's a lovely little book, actually, called, I think it's called Fearless Cities. Yeah. Although, when I gave a talk about that recently, there was somebody from Barcelona there who said that there had been some differences now, but they were working with it. Anyway, but there always are.
Yes, do we have anyone else here? Mia Skøen?
Yes. Yes.
Just for the online
audience.
Yes.
Oh,
so what Mia Skøen is asking is if you have any reflections if Fiona has any reflections on the need for political and economic change also. Mm. For instance, what kind of role for democracy in this?
Yes. No, well, as I said yesterday, the one crisis that I haven't included in this, I mean, I say in the book it's of a different order in a way, but it is the crisis of democracy. And I think that, that's a really difficult one when you look at some of the trends at the moment in terms of people just being turned off by politics and not being involved. But then on the other hand, you know, when I went through and I really researched, you know, what sort of local, especially at municipal level, actually, what sort of movements are there? What sort of changes are happening? There's so much change happening. And yet at a kind of national level, there's so little sort of ways in which people who are involved in local housing projects or local environmental projects, they don't see the connection between that and it's not surprising they don't see a connection between that and national politics, because national politics often will recognise these issues, but in a rather rhetorical way. You know, not in a way that says, okay, you know, we want to hear what you have to say. I mean, I think although some people are casting doubt on this, I think the citizens' assemblies, I don't know, you must have had citizens' assemblies. I think some of the citizens' assemblies, not all of them, but some of them have worked very well on getting people together and informing them about topics. But of course, the other thing is, you know, the difficulty around lack of trust in politics, the whole conspiracy theories development. But I kind of think the more the work is done at a local level, I mean, like I was saying, this stuff on environment and rivers and seas in the UK has really taken off, you know. It's very difficult for any political party to avoid it now. And it's just that some issues do become important, and you know, they just, well, I suppose I'm calling for people to be active, really. I'm calling for academics to be scholar activists, you know. Yes, so that was one. It was political, and what was the other one? Economic.
My question was mainly about the political.
Oh, right, okay. Yes. I mean, I think a lot of people are working on a different sort of economic system. And as I say, Kate Raworth's book is inspiring quite a lot of people. I think that's important there.
Questions, comments? I might come to an end of this seminar, I think. And I think this... a nice place to stop also with this note on the need for scholarly activism.
Yes.
So on that note, I would like to thank you, Fiona, for coming to Oslo. It's been a pleasure to have you here. And it's always a pleasure to listen to you and learn from your work. And as a small gratitude of our, as a small token of our gratitude, I brought also a small present with me.
Oh, right.
So this is a small book from what has become a Norwegian classic. Yeah.
Oh, right.
So it's written in 1994 by an author that has been compared to Thomas Bernhard, who you might know, from Austria.
Yes.
And this is Dag Solstad, Shameless, how it is called in English again. Skjønnsom Verdighet, it is called in English... Shyness and Dignity.
Oh, right. Yeah. How nice. And,
and it's a book about an inner dialogue of a teacher and his disappointments about his own career and frustrations about the students. So, but it has become a widely translated book and it's, I think it's worth reading. So.
Oh, right. Thank you very much. Mm. Wonderful.
So with that, thank you so much, and thank you to the audience who has also been with us online today, and to all of you who have been here present in person. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much. Yeah.